The only man in the history of the United States to be fired from the Library of Congress. I'm looking at him right now. Ezra Pound was his mentor. He is, in my opinion, and I've said it many times before, the best single researcher and author of conspiratorial material and the Federal Reserve in the history of the world. I'm looking at this guy over here. He looks much better this year than he did about 4 or 5 years ago when we were in Virginia Beach. He is a brilliant, brilliant man. He understands this conspiracy. Who's who, the names, the places, the dates, how it all stacks together to make this giant pyramid structure. Who's at the top, who's at the bottom, how it runs, who's oiling the machinery. And he puts it in such a way that even though it's complicated, he puts it simplistically. His book, Murder by Injection, you think, well, that's on medicine, right? It is. But it explains the whole thing on the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the whole pharmaceutical slash oil industry that controls cancer. Cancer being the second largest industry in the United States of America. I just got back from Beijing and Tonghua and discovering that there is an herbal elixir that does, in fact, enhance the immune system to the degree where it can cure cancer. But Eustace Mullins is going to talk about the conspiracy not to give us greater health, but to give us sickness and despair. By understanding the bad guys, by understanding this pharmaceutical industry, by understanding the New World Order and those who would screech Ein Volk, Ein Reich, Ein Führer, you can combat it. Because, like I say, if you liked what Hitler did, you're going to love what George Bush is doing. His book, The World Order, is magnificent. His book on the Federal Reserve is just pure brilliance. Would you all please stand with me right now and cheer the greatest living researcher in America, Eustace Mullins!
Thank you, Tony. Okay. All right, I'm glad you're here. It's conspiracy time. You know, a few years ago, I was in London with Bill Cooper, who is now deceased, and or murdered, and some people rented Wembley Arena, the biggest meeting place in England. They were going to fill it up with so many people wanted to hear about conspiracies. And when the press found out that I was going to be a speaker, they went wild. They had stories in all the newspapers, television stations, that Eustace Mullins is going to be here. It was almost panic. They did everything they could to stop me. When I landed at Heathrow Airport, they had the British officials were supposed to refuse to allow me to land in England because I was so dangerous. So these terrorists had gone to the British officials and said, "You have got to put Eustace on that plane and not let him come into our country." So the British officials who are not totally stupid, said, all right, show us his record. Show us what he's done. And so there was nothing. They had nothing to show. I mean, my record was as clean as a baby's bottom. So the British official said, we cannot deport Eustace Mullins. He hasn't done anything. So I was allowed to speak. But they put on such a press campaign that they knocked down the attendance of this great meeting to about one-tenth of what it should have been. And so Bill Cooper and I spent most of the time in the bar. There wasn't that much going on. But I have run into a lot of opposition. I was run out of Canada 3 times last year because the press simply goes berserk when my name is mentioned. And the reason is quite simple. They know that I know the details of the conspiracy, and they don't want you to hear them. So they'll do anything to stop me from speaking. I was nailed in Chicago on the way up here. I had gotten on my plane in Virginia, flew to O'Hare to get the plane to San Jose. And I was standing in line. We were boarding the plane to San Jose, and I was pulled out of the line. They said, two guys said, we need to give you a random screening. I said, you don't screen people when they're boarding. I was screened already. They put me over, and they went through my bag. There was nothing there. They had me put my arms up. And I said, do I look like an Arab to you? When I said that, they went berserk. There was a young black man and a young Hispanic man. And when I said this, they started screaming at me. They said, stop talking. Don't say anything. Shut up. Don't say anything. Then they called 2 supervisors. And one supervisor came from one side, one came from the other, right at me at a pincer movement, because I was obviously so dangerous, you know, that it would probably take 5 people to subdue me. So they told these supervisors, they said, he won't cooperate. And I said, that's my bag on the table. You've got my bag. And I said, you've got me. I said, how am I not cooperating? They said, you're talking. So I was afraid I'd miss my plane. I got a little concerned, a little nervous, which I don't usually. I usually enjoy this kind of encounter. I've been going through it for 50 years, and it's sort of fun. But I guess they caught me on a bad day, and I started getting a little nervous. So finally, they waved me on. I got on the plane, sat down, and the plane started to take off. And I felt something wet, and I reached up, and my hands were covered with blood. All of this pressure. I had a little high blood pressure, which had never bothered me before. And suddenly, I'm starting off on a 4-hour flight with a terrific nosebleed. So that was upsetting in itself. So I forced myself to be calm. I sat back and made it all right. The bleeding stopped. But when you get that kind of nosebleed from high blood pressure, you don't know where you're going. Sometimes you have to go to the hospital to have it stopped. And so anyway, it subsided. But when I got here, I found out why all this attention. They had gone through my bags at O'Hare, and they had taken out a can of shaving cream. I always get the giant size because it's a lot cheaper. And for some reason, they think that the giant size shaving cream is a bomb. Well, they call it a shave bomb, after all. And I don't think these people have the, with their limited intelligence, they think that a shave bomb must be a bomb. I even ran into that in Japan a few years ago. We were taking a flight from Tokyo to Sapporo, and I was with 3 Japanese gentlemen, and they wouldn't let us on the plane, and I didn't understand what was going on. And finally, one of the officials held up a bag, my bag, and pulled out this shaving can, and he said it was a bomb. And so the Japanese people told him that it was theirs. They wouldn't say it was mine. They said it was theirs, and they argued with him, and they finally let us on the plane. But you just don't know how dangerous a shave bomb is until you run into officials. So when I got here and unpacked here at the hotel, I found out that my shaving can was gone. And Also, I had brought along a picture of Thomas Jefferson, which I was sort of proud of. Some friends came down to University of Virginia a few years ago from Detroit. I had spoken up there several times. And there's a statue of Thomas Jefferson at the law school. There's about four statues of Jefferson around on UVA campus, but this particular one is a very nice one, and it's all secluded by itself. So my friends took pictures of me standing beside Jefferson, profile, and I had this picture. This happened in 1977, and I looked at the picture a few months ago, and I realized that our profiles, which were matched up, were exactly similar. Every feature was exactly similar. It was like a double. And so I brought that along. I was going to show it to you, but that picture also disappeared from my suitcase. And as far as I know, that's all they took was the shave bomb and the picture. But I know that the FBI loves to get pictures of me. I don't know why. But they've got lots of them, and they're always willing to get one more. So they got that one. I have copies of it, so I'll travel with it from now on. But I was very chagrined. I used to go to meetings, and the FBI would hop out of bushes. I was at a funeral in Culpeper of a friend of mine, George Lincoln Rockwell, a few years ago. And to get to the little cemetery, you had to walk through some bushes and through some backyards. And every bush that I passed, an FBI agent jumped out in front of me and snapped a picture. And so I thought, my gosh, I would think they'd have enough. But they always want one more, and so they got more. But this is a lot of attention. You know, I was under daily surveillance by the FBI for 33 years. I used to come out of my apartment in Chicago, and there'd be three carloads of FBI agents parked in front of on Lincoln Avenue, right down the street from the Biograph Theater where they assassinated John Dillinger, and two blocks from the Clark Street garage where the St. Valentine's Day massacre took place. Very historic area. Although at that time, there was a dump. They hadn't rebuilt it. Now it's a tourist attraction. So whenever I came out of my apartment, they would very ostentatiously take off their speaker microphones from the dashboard and hold it up so I could see it, because this was supposed to intimidate me. Well, in fact, it was sort of flattering. I thought, this is my public. And it never really bothered me. They used to come and knock on my door, and they would say, Eustace, can we come in and talk to you? And I would say, no. And they'd say, why? I'd say, because you steal things. And then these agents would say through the door, well, if we promise not to steal anything. Because they were assigned to talk to me, they had to talk to me. And in fact, they waited outside of my apartment one day and chased me down the alley. They were calling Mr. Mullins, Mr. Mullins. And finally they came up to me and they said, we'd like to talk to you. And so I got in the car. I mean, I'm a very naive person. I got in the car sitting between two FBI agents and we drove around. And they said, we only have one thing to ask you. Does anybody in the FBI owe you any money? Well, I was flabbergasted because I don't borrow money from anybody, particularly FBI agents. And I thought very seriously. I said, well, no, I don't think so. And they kept insisting. They said, think hard. Doesn't somebody in the FBI owe you money? And I thought, well, no, not to my knowledge. In fact, nobody owed me any money, as a matter of fact, FBI agents or not. And so they finally went away very disappointed. And about 6 months later, I began to realize they were trying to bribe me. I mean, I'm a little thick. Things don't always sink in. And what they wanted me to say was, yes, in fact, you guys owe me $5,000, and I don't know why you don't pay me. And they would have paid me on the spot. They would have given me $5,000 because they wanted to sign me up. They wanted me on the payroll. And so they went away disappointed. In fact, they've gone away disappointed every time they've come around because I don't have rapport with them. But the fact is that for 20 years in Washington, whenever I was visiting there, I stayed in the home of an important FBI official. They were my oldest friends. And finally, one day, this official was going to retire, and he asked me to meet him down on 9th and Constitution at the Department of Justice building. We were to have lunch. And he came up, and he was very dejected. He said, Eustace, I can't have lunch with you. I said, that's all right. And then he said, they've told me, I'm retiring in 6 months, they said, if they found out that you've been in my house again any time before I retire, they're going to take my pension. And I said, well, that's no problem, because this is the way these people live. These are the rules they live by. I said, I'll just stay away and until you retire. And he was so dejected, so humiliated by his own employers that he could not have a friend in his home who had never been arrested, never got a parking ticket in his life or anything. And to him, it was the most mortifying thing I'd ever done. I said, look, don't think about it. I didn't contact him until after he retired. Then I went right back, and that was my Washington headquarters. I stayed there all the time. But this is what you have to do. This is power. This is terrorism. This is intimidation. This is forcing you to acknowledge that you, as an American citizen, have no rights whatsoever. And, of course, I find that out in court. Whenever I go into court, let me tell you, when you go into an American court, Jerry Spence is one of the most famous attorneys in the United States. You see him on television. He wrote a book a few years ago called Justice for None. And the first sentence of that book is, there is no justice for any American in any American court. And I could verify that because I've been there many times and I have never seen any justice whatsoever. And neither has most people who come in, because it's that kind of country. They have that kind of power, and they're terrorists, and they have only one enemy, and that is you. They hate you because, first of all, you outnumber them, and because they're afraid of you. Because they're afraid that if you ever find out what they're doing to you, you'll tear them from limb to limb, which is just what you should do. So it's a state of war of the government against the people. And how do you win that war? You fight back. I've been fighting back for 60 years. I went into the Air Force in 1942, served throughout World War II, but I really didn't start to fight until after I got home. I came back to the home front, and I saw so much corruption and so much dictatorship that I've been fighting them ever since. Then I met my mentor, Ezra Pound, in Washington, D.C. I went to an art school. And Ezra Pound had been imprisoned in an insane asylum without trial. He served 13 and a half years without trial, the longest period of time without trial of anybody in American history. I finally got him out in 1958. And my record is a little unusual. I always considered myself a patriot, but my education was entirely sponsored by three men, all of whom were accused of treason. I went to Washington Lee University, which was founded by George Washington, which its president was Robert E. Lee, and they were tried for treason. They were not tried. They were accused of treason. They would have been hung if they'd been convicted. They were never convicted. Then Ezra Pound completed my education, was tried for treason, never tried for treason, but he was indicted. He was indicted by a man who knew all about treason, a man named Alger Hiss, a communist on the personal staff of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And Alger Hiss was very upset about Ezra Pound. And he had the Department of Justice indict him for treason. And it was so ridiculous that they never dared to try him. So when they brought back Ezra Pound to Washington, D.C., flew him back, they said, how are you going to defend yourself against the charge of treason? Ezra Pound said, I will stand by everything I have ever said or written. Well, that was the wrong answer. That brought consternation. They did not want him. They want you to grovel. They want you to say, I'm wrong. That's what they did with Gordon Liddy. You know, Gordon Liddy refused to grovel, and he served the longest period of time of any of the Watergate people because he refused to give in. He refused to cringe and to say, I'm so sorry for what I've done. One of the ladies who came to see Ezra Pound at St. Elizabeth's Hospital was a very famous scholar named Edith Hamilton. And so Ezra Pound asked her one day, he said, "Now, Edith, you've been an active lady all your life. Have you ever regretted anything that you've ever done?" And she said, "No, I have never regretted one day of my life." And he said, "Neither have I. And I personally feel the same. If you have to regret something, you must have done something wrong. But if you're fighting for your country, you're doing the right thing. And you'll never regret it as long as you live. This is the way of life. This is the way of the American patriot. This is the way this country was founded. And this country was founded by a revolution. And what did Thomas Jefferson say? He said, you have to have a revolution every 25 years. And it's true. Because within 20 years or so, the people in power began to like their comfortable lives. They don't want to give it up. They'll do anything to keep their power over you. And so they will start to oppress you, and they'll oppress you more and more and more. So my life has been as the protege of three men accused of treason. And I became the protege of other people. I became the protege of H.L. Hunt, the richest man in the world. And the reason that H.L. and I liked each other, he was a very brilliant guy. And we got along fine. I will say this, that in all the people that I have ever met who were real Americans, we never disagreed on one thing. We never argued. We never quarreled. Because we believed in the same thing. We were Americans. We're for America. We have no other allegiances. You have the President of the United States cringing in public, George W., and saying, "We must defend Israel." I never heard a president say, "We must defend Israel or any other country." We elected him to defend the United States. But unfortunately, George W. is a prisoner of the most dangerous and ruthless people in the world, and that is the Israeli Fifth Column, which totally governs this country. You have no Congress. You have no president. You have the Israeli Fifth Column. And what is the Fifth Column there? A Fifth Column's function is to disrupt and destroy the country and make it the prisoner of a foreign government. And that's what these people are dedicated to doing. Kenneth Edelman, Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowski, Billy Crystal, all these people are totally loyal and dedicated to the state of Israel. They hate America. They hate you. They would like to see you enslaved for the rest of your life, and they're doing everything they can to achieve that objective. So in my experience, there is only one thing to do, and that is to speak out and to go. I travel everywhere, and I tell people. This is Paul Revere time. This is toxin time. Sound the toxin. Let the people know the enemy is here, and we are ready to fight. And that's been the story of my life, and it's been a very interesting life and a very full life. And I've met so many wonderful people, and people like Ezra Pound who would work with me endlessly because they knew that I would carry the ball. And that's exactly what I have done. I started off in Chicago as a magazine writer, and then I went with motor club, and we had a little newspaper which published bulletins, and every day I would call up the City News Bureau, which was a local reporter's outfit, and give them bulletins for their papers. And one of the men I used to call was a young reporter named Walter Cronkite. And I always called Walter Cronkite Walter Crankcase, because he was so full of oil. And Walter Crankcase became one of the most prominent correspondents. He is still today a director of Columbia Broadcasting System, CBS. Well, he was to be replaced by a classmate of mine from Washington Lee University named Roger Mudd, who also was a descendant of Dr. Samuel Mudd, who was accused of treason because he set a man's broken leg. And this offended some people in Washington, so they put him in prison for life. And so Roger became a very good journalist, didn't have a mean bone in his body. And he interviewed Senator Kennedy on his radio television program once. And Kennedy poured out this story about how he fought against the raging tides to save his pregnant girlfriend. And I go to Martha's Vineyard every year, and I have seen the place where this tragedy occurred. The water is 4 feet deep. Now, you couldn't even drown Chandra Levy in water 4 feet deep. So that's where the pregnant girlfriend drowned. And so Kennedy got so agitated about tourists coming there that he had the Massachusetts State Highway Department tear down the bridge because he was running for re-election, a tight re-election, and hundreds of people were flocking to see the bridge and driving down there. So he had to rip out the whole bridge. I think they put it back now, but for about 5 years you couldn't even drive down there. But these people are so cowardly. They're fearful all the time. They don't enjoy their power because they're so afraid of you. And what you've got to do is to hate them as much as they hate you, frankly. I'm not an apostle of hate, but that's what you have to do. In your own self-interest, you have to know these people, know what they're doing, know what their programs are, and that's why they go after me with all these newspaper stories, TV denunciations. I spoke at a meeting of the Constitution Party, Pennsylvania, a couple of weeks ago. I was invited to come and speak. When I got there, they had backed down. They didn't make a reservation for me at the hotel. And they said, we're told that you're anti-Semitic. And I said, who told you that? Bring them in. Let me hear the witnesses. Well, they didn't have any witness. They had some words typed on a piece of paper, paragraph, which they claimed was from one of my books. It's a book that I never even published, and I haven't seen it. And they didn't have a copy of it. But they said, did you write this? I said, certainly not. Then they said, well, will you, before you speak, will you assure the audience that you're not anti-Semitic? I said, certainly I will, and I did. And so I balked them at every turn, but I finally had to sue them. I threatened to sue them to get my pay because they refused to pay me. But they were just a bunch of rats who had decided they were going to give me the business, and it didn't work. And the reason they attacked me in Chicago, if you've seen Sid Skolnick's writings, Sid is a very aggressive reporter up there. And he uncovered the story of Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency. Mossad got its income from the Chicago Public Works Department because the mayor was Jake Arvey, a Zionist, and he was backed by Colonel Henry Crown, the armaments king, General Dynamics Corporation. And so they cooked up a scheme where they had 10,000 alleged workers at the Chicago Public Works Department who didn't exist. And those 10,000 checks every month went to Mossad, and that's where Mossad, they became the most powerful intelligence agency in the world because of that income every month. And in fact, a repercussion of this happened a couple of years ago when all of downtown Chicago started to be flooded, all of the old sewer pipes collapsed, and everything was flooded downtown Chicago because no work had been done there for many years. The 10,000 mythical workers did no work, and all the money went to Mossad. Well, they knew that I knew this, and so they were laying for me when I landed at O'Hara Airport, and I wasn't expecting a thing. I thought I was just going to get on my plane and fly out here. It didn't turn out that easy, but I made it anyway, because whatever you do, keep going. Don't look back, and Satchel Paige used to say, if you look back, you'll see whether they're gaining on you or not, and you don't, and you don't want to do that. Just keep on running. And that's the way to go for it. But as I say, they kept Ezra Pound in prison for 13 and a half years. And I met a newspaper man who, a congressman owed him a favor. His father owned a newspaper in North Dakota, the biggest newspaper there. And he backed Usher Burdick for election to Congress. And so Usher Burdick owed him a favor. So Rex went to Usher Burdick and said, I took Rex to meet Ezra Pound. And Rex talked to him, and he said, well, you don't belong in here. And Ezra Pound said, don't you think I know that? And so he said, I'll do something about it. So he went to Usher Burdick, and Usher Burdick went on the floor of Congress and said, why is the government holding this man? There was no answer, because they had no reason to hold him. So they had an eight-minute hearing, and after 13 and a half years, Ezra Pound walked out a free man. But they made one proviso, that he leave the country, even though he's a citizen in good standing. Well, he had married an English girl, and they had lived in Italy, so he was perfectly willing to leave. But I wish he had stayed, because the United States needed him. They need him today, because this was a very great man. And he initiated and commissioned me to write the Federal Reserve book, because he knew it was important. And I went to the Library of Congress, and I got the material, and I published it, and it's been in print since 1953, and many subsequent editions. But he was the spark plug which got me onto this whole thing. He had studied world politics for 30 years, because many of his young friends in the First World War had been killed, young artists, young writers, and he wanted to find out why. Why were these people dying? He couldn't find out why the war was being fought. Well, it was quite a few years before I found out why the war was fought, and I found out through Winston Churchill. Although the Industrial Revolution originated in England, they became obsolete, and the Germans began to manufacture things, and they were so superior. Their products were so better and newer and more modern. And the British could not compete with them. So by 1910, England was facing bankruptcy because they couldn't sell their products abroad. People preferred the German products. And because of this, you had World War I and World War II. That was the only reason. Germany and England had no quarrels. In fact, they were cousins, the Kaiser Wilhelm and King George V of England were first cousins. They were part of Queen Victoria's family. In fact, so was the Tsarina of Russia. At that time, the aristocracy of Europe was just one big family. So there was no reason for any war. And suddenly we had this terrible war. And it was done through assassination of Franz Ferdinand. But it was all a put-up job. And then they had a replay in 1939. And Ezra Pound came back to his native country from England to tell the American people, don't be suckers a second time. Don't get drawn into a second world war. And Charles Lindbergh was saying the same thing, America first. Many prominent Americans were saying this. But it did not have any effect, because the money behind the war was so big that there was no way that they could not have it. And so they had the war. And they had it through what they call Pearl Harbor. Now, when we had the attack on the World Trade Center, they initially said, it's another Pearl Harbor. Then they backed up on that, because they realized that by now, most people in this country knew that Pearl Harbor had been staged. The Japanese had more or less been suckered into attacking it. And there were traitors in their own government, actually, who caused them to attack Pearl Harbor. And so So the mention of Pearl Harbor brought up memories that they didn't want to, so they dropped the Pearl Harbor thing. Then they decided to call their war against terrorism a crusade, and they were hastily told, you got to drop that, because the crusades were, of course, the historic wars between Christians and Muslims in the Middle East, which is still going on today. And they didn't want to get into that. So they finally settled on something very bland. They called it Homeland Security. And Homeland Security meant that you could be secure in your homeland as long as you were surrounded by armed guards, as long as you had to fight your way in and out of an airport to get on an airplane, and that you would have cameras everywhere taking your picture because you might do something evil or something treasonable, which, of course, most Americans are not even contemplating doing. We're good citizens, we live good lives, we're not into crime, and But we are the people who are being surveilled. We're the people who are being pursued. I was dragged out of a line a few days ago at O'Hare Airport to be scanned. And there was nothing to scan. And when I put my arms up, they said, "Don't put your arms up like that. You're supposed to do it like this." And I said, I'm not used to being arrested. You'll have to tell me what I'm supposed to do. And I almost had a small riot. I had these two inspectors, and then I had the two supervisors rushing at me. And you would have thought John Dillinger was on the loose, you know. Stop this guy. Stop him before he kills more. But I survived that, and I've survived many things. But as I say, the 33 years of FBI surveillance that I endured, I found very interesting, and it showed what the country has come to. Because they have to fight phantoms. They don't want to fight the real enemy because the real enemy is in the conspiracy and they're running the show. So the conspirators are fighting you, and that's why we're here today. And in fact, I think Brian may have overlooked, he thanked a number of people about making this meeting possible, but I think he missed one, and that was Dan Rather. I think that you wouldn't even come here today if it wasn't for Dan Rather lying every night, and you have to come here to find out what's going on. If Dan Rather would tell the truth, if the media would tell the truth, you wouldn't need to come to San Jose. You could turn on your television and see what's going on, bring you up to date. But because they give you nothing but lies, nothing but propaganda, that's why we have this meeting, and that's why we're fighting the conspiracy, because we're tired of being lied to. We were lied into two world wars. We were lied into Korea. We were lied into Vietnam. The Cold War hoax, I've written articles about it for a year. I called it the $5 trillion hoax. The Cold War was created out of nothing because... Well, I'm getting to that. The Soviet Union was created with our money. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York put up the money for the Bolshevik Revolution. The Bank of England put up the money for the Bolshevik Revolution. And in fact, in Hitler Germany, the German banks and the German industrialists didn't like Hitler. They wouldn't give him any money. So the Rothschilds had to have the Bank of England finance the Nazi movement. And at the end of the war, when they tried the Nazi so-called war criminals, they never touched the bankers who had the Baron Schroeder, and one of the members was a director of the Bank of England, and they were never indicted. They were quietly released, and the people that they indicted and tried at Nuremberg, of course, were the figureheads. But the real powers behind World War II and the Nazi Party were never tried and have never been tried to this day because their minions were tried and executed. And in fact, in my book on Murder by Injection, I point out that they actually went after some of the officials of IG Farben in Germany. And IG Farben was controlled by the Rothschilds. They had an American branch of IG Farben, which Paul Warburg, founder of the Federal Reserve System, was a director. And IG Farben's goal was to control the chemical industry of the entire world. And so they set up an American branch and a South American branch and a European branch. And it was the IG Farben people in Germany who were tried and executed for experiments on prisoners. And they have carried on those same experiments on prisoners in this country ever since, and nobody is arrested. They give them $1 a day for enduring these experiments, the same experiments that people were hung at Nuremberg for doing in Germany. So what's good in one country is not necessarily good in another country, apparently. But I do say that under this conspiracy, in the United States today, anything goes. And that's the problem. The courts will stand up for anything. They will not let the citizens get into court and seek legal redress because they are stacking the cards against you. And I've had many legal experiences. I've got a lawsuit going on in Virginia right now against a doctor in the hospital because they tried to kill me, which is understandable. I went to the hospital one night, and I had some heart fibrillation. And so they went into the emergency room, and the nurse in the emergency room said, "Are you the one that wrote that book?" Well, that makes you a little nervous. They know who you are. And in fact, one of the biggest problems, the eighth leading cause of death in the United States, is physicians' errors. Eighth leading cause of death, 93,000 a year. So they have reason to be nervous because they don't want any supervision, they don't want any investigation, and one of the biggest problems in the medical field today is iatrogenic medicine. Iatrogenic medicine means physician-induced illnesses. Now, I came out of the hospital recently, and I came home, and I developed an enormous, swollen, poison cyst right next to my heart. And I thought, boy, this is bad. Well, I had it operated on. Then I developed Bell's palsy. My whole face was paralyzed. I'm still squinting right now, so believe me, it's if I look a little sinister, it's not my problem, because that was done to me by the doctors. So I have suits against them, and they are frantically trying to dismiss it, insufficient cause of action. Trying to kill you is not a cause of action in American law. So we'll see how that goes, but this is how they operate. And so anyway, I got Ezra Pound out of prison, and my latest project is to show the Israeli fifth column in the United States. And that, the Assistant Secretary of Defense. You know, a few days ago, we had a big meeting in Washington, D.C., and who was there but the acting Deputy Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz, leading a rally to help Israel. I mean, he's working for the American government, but you'd never know it from his actions, because he and all of his cohorts were there on the Mall in Washington having this great rally to help Israel. Because at least they're honest about what they're doing. They're frank about it. They're not trying to deceive anybody. They're not going to do anything for the American people, but they're going to devote their life to Israel. And I think that's fine. I think they should go there and devote their lives to Israel. But just get out of this country. Now, after 9/11, by the way, you might have seen some commentary about the fact that the government, no one in the government wants to touch 9/11. They don't want any investigation. 11 days after Pearl Harbor, they had the first of eight investigations going in Washington about Pearl Harbor. But now they don't want to touch any investigation, and the reason is they're terrified that you will find out what happened. So, no investigation. The Democrats and the Republicans are in accord on this, and President Bush is in accord on this, that there will be no investigation because there are too many unexplained stories. There is the disappearing plane which hit the Pentagon. They can't find any trace of it. And so it must have been a detonation of some kind. And, of course, the World Trade Centers. If you've ever seen demolition buildings on the television, you see how gracefully the thing sinks to the ground. Well, this is exactly what the Twin Trade Towers did in New York. You saw them sinking gracefully down. Now, an entire building does not sink down when a plane hits it. I don't care where the plane hits it, at the bottom or the top. But they were mostly at the top. But there again, General Parton is a good friend of mine, and he was the explosives demolition expert for the United States Air Force. And he tried for months to testify in the Oklahoma City bombing. They wouldn't touch him. They wouldn't let him testify because they didn't want his expert witness testimony. Leading demolition expert could not testify about the Oklahoma City bombing because he had stated and has stated many times that the Oklahoma City bombing came from inside out. They parked this truck out front, which supposedly blew up the whole building, but it didn't make any hole where it was parked. because these were real demolition experts, and they directed the whole explosion into the building, leaving the street absolutely safe where it was. You could have been under the street and you wouldn't have been hurt. So that is how they're constantly defending their lies and their conspiracies, and that's why you're here, because believe me, we have got conspiracies enough for everybody. I've been denounced in the press many times as a conspiratologist. And a conspiratologist is not a person who knows anything about conspiracies. He's a person who invents conspiracies. And I have never had to invent a conspiracy in my life. I can't keep up with all the ones that are already going on. But conspiracy itself is apparently the American way of life. The Federal Reserve was conspiracy was one of the most famous of the conspiracies. My book on the Federal Reserve System, for about 20 years, I published editions of it under the name The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, because that's what it was and that's what it is. And I'm the only person who ever called it a criminal syndicate. I said the Federal Reserve System is not federal, no more than Federal Express. It has no reserves. It doesn't need any reserves because they could print all the money that they want. Why? If you got the printing presses, why do you need reserves? And it's not a system, because it's a criminal syndicate. These people conspired to rob the people of the United States. That is a criminal conspiracy. You can't, under law, you cannot define it any other way. And of course, no one has ever indicted the Federal Reserve people or pursued them legally on this, because you can't get into the courts. When you go into the court, who is sitting there but the judge? I had a judge. I sued the Anti-Defamation League for $100 million a few years ago. And I went before the D.C. court in Washington, D.C. And this is down at 3rd and Pennsylvania Avenue. When I used to walk my friend George Stimson, the founder of the National Press Club, he would walk home down Pennsylvania Avenue in the evening to Capitol Hill, where he lived in a little hotel there. And we would walk by two buildings. One building was the Masonic Building, and the next building was the Standard Oil Building, Standard Oil Office Building. They were fairly modest buildings because they had limitations on how high the buildings could be. And we would walk past these two buildings. They were the most two prominent buildings on Pennsylvania Avenue. Well, they finally realized it was a little obvious, so they tore them both down and they built a big new courthouse at 3rd at Constitution, and that's the federal courthouse. That's where I went with my lawsuit. Well, the judge that they assigned to me was named Judge Harold Green. And Harold Green was the one that broke up the American telephone system, because the people in Russia were always complaining to the United States that we had such a wonderful telephone system, and they had a lousy telephone system, and it made them look bad. So Judge Harold Green decided, well, if we want to get along with the Russians, we've got to make our telephone system as bad as theirs. I mean, these people have odd ways of thinking. It's very difficult for you to follow their line of thoughts, because they're insane. Criminally insane. And as I say, I got my education in the insane asylum under Ezra Pound, so I know all about it. I went to 4 of the best universities in the United States, and I didn't get any education. And we were all veterans, and we would have meetings at night, and we'd say, what's going on? We're not getting any education here at these famous universities. And they didn't know what to do about it. They were very concerned, and the professors were all like scared rabbits. They were scared to death. They were scared to open their mouths. And, you know, we were fighters. We were young people, and we were willing to fight. And we could not understand why these professors, who had very secure positions and lived well, were so scared. They were always scared. They were scared rats, and they're scared rats today. And that's because they do not stand for anything. They have no character. They have no backbone. And they won't fight for America. So we would have these meetings and wonder why we weren't getting any education. And I finally left the university and went to Washington to go to art school. I said, I might as well study art. I can't learn anything at an American university. In fact, in my biography of Ezra Pound, I stated No one is so cut off from learning as a student at an American university. I wrote that in 1959, and it's just as true today as it was then. And so, because I write and say things like this, I'm not too popular in some quarters. But that doesn't bother me, because I'm not looking for popularity. I just want to tell people the facts and let them. I want to give people information so that you can act on it, because one person alone cannot do it. But the American people are a sleeping giant, and we're beginning to wake up, and I see it every day, everywhere in this country. We're fed up. We realize that we've got to put an end to these lies. We've got to put an end to this corruption. We've got to put an end to this treason. We cannot have a foreign fifth column running the government of the United States. It's as simple as that. Now, I wrote an article for Rick Martin a couple of years ago, 5 years ago, called The Cold War Hoax, which stated that it was a $5 trillion hoax on the American people. And that was verified by one of the leading Israeli fifth columnists, an editor named Norman Potteretz, who edits the Commentary magazine in New York City for the American Jewish Committee. And in his autobiography, he boasted that the whole Cold War was created out of nothing, simply so that the United States would have an enormous defense budget and we could furnish all of our military equipment to Israel so that they could fight the Arab nations. That's what it was all about. The Cold War was about Israel. It had nothing to do with the Soviet Union. And, of course, the Soviet Union was being supported by the American taxpayer since 1917. That's all in my book, all documented, never been challenged by anybody. Do you know, in 50 years, I have never been able to get anyone to debate me. And I love to debate. I'd like to debate for hours. Let the other person give their opinion, their documentation. I'd like to hear it. I'd like to challenge it. They will not do it. I have appeared at debates where there would be an empty chair. Someone was going to debate me, but they didn't show up. I appeared before the Fairfax Republican County Committee, which is a very important committee in Washington and Northern Virginia. And in fact, they were the ones that actually got Reagan nominated for president. And we were going to talk about the Federal Reserve System, and an official of the Federal Reserve agreed to appear, named Robert Stern. Well, he did appear, and we debated, and that's the only debate I ever had. And 6 weeks later, Robert Stern had a Washington heart attack. So nobody's ever debated me since, because I guess they realize it's just too damn dangerous. But I've seen so many things like that happen. And as I say, the Cold War was totally phony, because we had created this demon, this monster, which did not exist. Russia was and is and always has been a third world nation. One reason for that, the reason communism was imposed on Russia was it was the richest nation in the world. The Tsar of Russia was the richest man in the world. He controlled wealth, which was unimaginable anywhere in the world. And because of that, his cousins in Germany and England, who were the kings of Germany and England, hated him, envied him. Rich people have a lot of envy. They can't stand to see anybody who has any more money than they have, because it just kills them. They can't even live. They say, that SOB has got 10 times as much money as I have. And they can't sleep at night. It's just something they can't get over. So they murdered the Tsar and took his money. And in imposing communism on the American people, which was done by the British Secret Service, by the way, the Russian people had no part in the Russian Revolution. Didn't even know what was going on. It was done by the British Secret Service, working for King George. So they took all of Tsar's gold, and they shipped it to the Bank of England and to the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. And that left the nation, the new nation of Soviet Russia, with no money. So we had to start sending them money right away. because their money was in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. So the American taxpayers had to make up the difference. That's the way things work. It doesn't. I don't know if it makes any sense or not, but that's the way it works anyway. And so the Russians had no capital, no gold, and so they've been supported by the American taxpayer ever since. We have had relief missions to Russia in 1917, 1919, 1921, and J.P. Morgan Company became the biggest supporter of Soviet Russia. Dwight Morrow, who became the father-in-law of Charles Lindbergh, Jr., was their biggest supporter, J.P. Morgan. Now, the communists were supposedly, they hated capitalists and they hated banks and bankers. But yet, J.P. Morgan, the most famous banker in the world, was practically the sole supporter of the Soviet Union. And for many years, only two people could land at Moscow Airport without permission, flying any time. They were Armand Hammer, founder of the Communist Party of the United States, and David Rockefeller, who may be the real founder of the Communist Party, I don't know. But anyway, Armand Hammer had the title and David Rockefeller had the money. They could land at Moscow Airport without getting shot down, but no one else could. If they approached the airport, they'd be shot down immediately. So that shows you who the real power is. In 1936, a member of Paul Warburg's banking firm, Otto Kahn, Kuhn Loeb & Company in New York, which was a Rothschild operation, he landed at Moscow Airport. And Stalin himself, the ruler of Russia, who murdered 1 million people a year, came out to visit him, came out to welcome him, and practically groveled before Otto Kahn, a little Jewish banker from New York, because that's where the real power was. Stalin had power in Russia, but he had no power anywhere else. If he walked outside the borders of Russia, he'd be nobody. But these bankers are powerful all over the world, and where they go, they're revered. People hang on every word, and they absolutely listen to them and will do anything that they say. And that's the kind of world we have because the money people exercise the reins of power. And they can call themselves democracies, they can call themselves fascists, they can call themselves Nazis or communists, but they're all the same people. And the people in those countries, we denounce communist countries and fascist countries, but this country, as many commentators have said over and over again, is becoming the most fascist country in the world because the government becomes more powerful, the people are stripped of their liberties, and we have these plebiscite elections where the candidates for election refuse to tell you what they stand for. They don't dare tell you what they stand for because if they did, you wouldn't vote for them. So this is what we have, the plebiscites, and we used to denounce the Nazis during the 30s for having plebiscites where people would vote for their nominated candidates and they really had no choice. And we have the same thing. But the Cold War itself was the greatest travesty of all time because there was never any war between Soviet Russia, this great menace which was about to crush the United States, and the roads were collapsing. Paul Roberts and other economists visited Russia during the 1960s, 1970s, and they were appalled. They said, this is a third world country. Why are we afraid of this country? Because the American people were not informed of this. They were told how the Soviet economy was booming. The Central Intelligence Agency was doing its job, which is to sell propaganda to the American people for whatever government program is going on. And the CIA was issuing these glowing reports every year of the enormous Soviet army, the most powerful army in the world, and the Soviet economy, the fastest growing economy in the world. And we were reading this. These were official CIA reports. They'd give them to Congress, and Congress would say, now we've got to increase our defense budget again. We're spending $280 billion a year. We've got to increase again because the Soviets are becoming more of a menace every day. And the Soviet Union did not even exist as a military power. They finally went into Afghanistan, and a few tribesmen in Afghanistan crushed them, and the whole country collapsed. That was the end of communism, because they went into Afghanistan. So it was obvious that they would never have attacked the United States. It wouldn't have lasted 2 days. But this is the sort of misinformation that you get from official sources. And because of this kind of information, we do not know what's going on. We have to make decisions about our country when we don't have the facts. We have no information. That's why you're here today, to get your information. Because you don't get it from the press. You don't get it from Dan Rather. All he's doing is carrying out the government propaganda. And we don't need any more propagandists. We want the truth. And that's why we come here. And this is a growing sentiment throughout the United States. Now, there is more and more information going because of the internet and because people have email and voicemail, and the government doesn't know what to do because the people are getting information. They're not depending on the CIA. They're not depending on the FBI. And this puts them up the creek because they have to now reorganize their programs because you people are finding out what's going on. You're finding out the motivations behind all of these mysterious foreign policy adventures, NATO, going into Somalia, going into Haiti, bombing Yugoslavia. You know, the old Nazis must have felt real good about bombing Yugoslavia because Hitler had this ambitious plan for bombing Yugoslavia into rubble during World War II. And those plans were interrupted by his war against Russia. So it never happened. So along comes NATO many years later and absolutely carries out the Hitler plan of bombing Yugoslavia into rubble, which Hitler had come up with in 1942. It took them a few years, but they got it done. And that's the whole story of the bombing of Yugoslavia. It was the Nazi program. And in fact, NATO is the Nazis of today. And I was told this in Japan, of all things. The granddaughter of the last emperor, Meiji Emperor, told me this. And she had gone to Yugoslavia to talk to Milosevic and to tell him this. And he knew it. That's why he's on trial today. He's on trial because he opposed the Nazi bombing of Yugoslavia by NATO. And so he's on trial for his life as a supposed war criminal. And I don't know what happened to Yugoslavia, and I don't think anyone else will ever know. But you haven't heard much about his trial lately because things disappear from the press. It's very interesting. They have an arch criminal, and they're going to have a trial, and they're going to wreak vengeance on this terrible criminal. Then suddenly it all kind of fades away. Nothing happens. You remember the great furor about anthrax after 9/11. Well, anthrax was the greatest danger in the world. Everybody was talking anthrax, and a senator said he got a letter with some anthrax in it and so forth. And we were supposed to be terrified of anthrax. So I wrote an article for Rick Martin, which I titled, "Anthrax is as American as Apple Pie." Which it was. Anthrax as a weapon was contrived in the United States because Winston Churchill had decided that they'd had to have two wars against the German people, and they couldn't go on like this because Britain did not have the wherewithal to continue fighting wars against Germany, and they couldn't compete with them. So Winston Churchill, being a practical person, decided to exterminate the entire Russian people, the entire German people. And so he came to the leading chemist in the United States, James Conant, president of Harvard University. And he said to Conant, "I need something to wipe out the German people." Now, the Germans are supposed to be the great exterminationists. They're supposed to be the people who want to exterminate other people. But in fact, the only candidates for extermination in the 20th century have been the German people. Because Churchill said to Conant, "Get me something that'll kill every human being in Germany." And Conant said, "Well, fine." You know, after all, he was president of Harvard University, and he wouldn't be shocked by a request like that. So So he finally told Churchill. He said, I think anthrax would be the thing to do it. And so Churchill says, go ahead and develop it. And he developed anthrax cakes, which would be dropped in Germany. And it would be fodder for animals, which was impregnated with anthrax. And the cattle would eat this, and then the people would eat the cattle, which the Germans would eat the cattle, which were now heavily impregnated with anthrax, and they would die slow, agonizing deaths. Well, this seemed to be just the right thing. So they developed, they built, they made 5 million of these anthrax cases, and they were going to drop them in Germany. But then the war ended. The Germans quit on us, and so they never had a chance to exterminate them. So these 5 million anthrax cakes were stored in England for many years, and finally, in the 1970s, they realized they had to get rid of them, so they burned them. So here you had clouds of burning anthrax going over England. I don't know how many people that killed, because nothing was ever said about it. And so then we heard nothing more about anthrax, and just suddenly they said, Saddam Hussein of Iraq has anthrax. Well, if he had anthrax, it came from the United States, because we were the only people that produced anthrax. But no, nothing was said about that. So all of a sudden, we had this terrible weapon, which we had to be fearful of anthrax. And the papers were full of it, the news programs every night, anthrax, anthrax, anthrax. And this went on for months. And then when my article came out about anthrax is America's apple pie, anthrax disappeared from the news. How long has it been since you've heard of anthrax? They'll mention it once in a while in a passing, but the great campaign of anthrax was abandoned because I had exposed the fact that James Conant had worked on it right here during the war at Fort Detrick, Maryland, same place they developed AIDS, by the way. They're very active at Fort Detrick. They come up with a lot of stuff. And So they just had to give up on the anthrax, because they were using the anthrax scare to also have a new smallpox scare. They were saying that the bioterrorists not only are going to give us anthrax, but they're going to spread smallpox. So they had 17 million decaying doses of smallpox vaccine, which they wanted to get rid of. So the government was going to inject these with 17 million Americans with these doses, which were probably... They admitted a lot of them would be fatal because they were no longer usable. And they finally had to abandon that. But the pharmaceutical companies were dead set on going ahead with the great smallpox vaccination, which never happened because the risks were too great. They would have killed thousands of people. So they had to abandon that. And, of course, I say they abandoned the great anthrax campaign. But these things disappear very quickly from the news. You never hear it again. None of your commentators will say, whatever happened to the great anthrax scare, whatever happened to the great smallpox scare, they simply go on to other things because they have new programs coming up all the time. And it's a corporation mentality because we have a corporate state, and corporations develop programs to promote this and to promote that, and every employee has got to get behind this 100%. And if you have any laggards who say, well, I'm a little dubious about this, they're out the door before they know what happened to them. And that once you get out on those terms, you don't get employment anywhere else. Because when you leave one corporation, if you don't have a recommendation from them, you can't go to another corporation and get a job. That's how they operate. So another thing that I wrote about recently was called the $6 trillion robbery. Now, the $6 trillion robbery was the Great Recession of 2000. Between March and November of 2000, Alan Greenspan, chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, finally brought about the recession that he wanted. It took six rapid interest rate increases to bring the country and the economy to the point of collapse. Six increases before he could do this. Now, during the great boom years, what they call the new economy, Greenspan had initiated 22 measures over the years at the Federal Reserve Board to increase the flow of money, increase the supply of money. And so the stock market boomed, and the prices kept going up and up and up. And so then, one man, supposedly, of course he doesn't do it alone, Greenspan, was told it's time to have a crash. So he started initiating these interest rate increases. And the financial commentator said, why is he doing this? And Greenspan said, there's the threat of inflation. And the Wall Street Journal said, there is no inflation. And he said, yes, but there might be. Some point in the future, we may have inflation. So we've got to act now promptly so that this inflation won't develop. And so, and of course, it was all fake. Everything these people do is fake and lies. They have no background whatsoever for it. Milton Friedman has said for 50 years that the Federal Reserve has caused every financial problem in this country since it was initiated in 1914. And Milton Friedman should know because he was the official consultant to the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. So he knew what he was talking about. But he actually disagreed with many of the things that the Federal Reserve did because they were too artificial, too contrived. They had no basis whatsoever, for no financial information behind them. They simply did it because this was their program. They wanted the market to go up or they wanted the market to go down. And they had the mechanism to do it. They had the interest rate increase. They had the fact that the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee could buy or sell government bonds on the open market. That either increases or decreases the supply of money. And the stock market daily prices are totally dependent on the money supply. If it goes down, the prices go down. If it goes up, if the money increases, they go up. So people on the inside always know which way it's going to go. They know 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 days ahead of time. And they can get in there and make their money. And if you're buying stocks, you have no idea any of this is going on. And you have these Wall Street analysts who are constantly telling you, oh, this is a good buy. You better get this. This is going up. And you buy it, and it goes down. Because Greenspan has done something to decrease the money supply, and the stock goes down. Then you don't know whether to panic and sell it or whether to hold it and it'll come back up. Well, it always comes back up. You know, J.P. Morgan was asked one day by a reporter. He said, Mr. Morgan, this is about 1910, said, Mr. Morgan, what is the market going to do? And J.P. Morgan said, my dear sir, the market will fluctuate. And that's how he made his living, because it fluctuated. If the market remains stable, after all, the worth of United States steel is about the same from one day to the next, but the market goes up and down because it's being manipulated. And as I say, U.S. Steel itself has the same resources, the same profits that it had last week, but the market will drop 5 points. And that's because of the way that they manipulate the markets. And that's how they steal from you. And so the $6 trillion loss which American people suffered from March to November 2000, I call it the $6 trillion robbery. Greatest robbery in history. Al Capone never made as much money in his whole life as the Federal Reserve people make in one day. Never. Al Capone complained, by the way, to the press. He felt he was getting a raw deal. He was always being held up in the press as such a gangster, you know. And he said, I don't know why you reporters write these things about me. He said, I'm just another businessman. And that was true. But he was a small-time businessman. The big boys didn't even know he existed. They got their liquor from him. But Al Capone could never touch the resources and the money that these Federal Reserve bankers rake in every day of the year. They've got the biggest theft operation going. I call it the federal robbery system. And the income tax, which they set up, by the way, to protect their own fluctuations of the market by simply taxing you so you'll have less money to spend. And they don't care how much money you have, but it's a control mechanism. It keeps you in line. You want to go out and buy something, you can't do it because the Internal Revenue has withheld it from your salary as a tax. And that's how they... It's actually the jackboot pressing down on your neck forever, 1984, George Orwell. We've got everything that George Orwell predicted in 1984. We've got the newspeak, doublespeak, everything. It's all happening here every day. And he wrote this back in 1948. And many people like myself really like to study 1984 because it's an absolute blueprint for everything that you've seen happen in the last 50 years. The control of the people, manipulation, and always at the bottom is government force. The government does not ever expect to persuade you to do anything or convince you to do anything, so they use force. And that's always the who comes to your house but the armed FBI agent carrying a gun. And you don't even have a gun, but he has the gun, and so you have to pay up. And this is the way, it's always force. There is no philosophy of government behind it. There is no benevolent intentions towards your being a citizen of this country. And in fact, the way that they send money out of the country to other countries shows that they have no loyalty to this country. I have, for years, stated that on the income tax deductions, they should not be allowed to deduct anything that's sent out of the country. I mean, if you want to give money to a charity in the United States, that should be deductible. But if it goes out of our borders, it should not be deductible. If you want to send money to England or Israel, that's fine. But why should the other taxpayers have to pay up in order so that you can do this? And you know that for 50 years, I'm the only person that's ever made that proposition. None of your politicians in Washington would ever touch us with a 10-foot pole because it's the foreign payments which they live on. Because that's where the big kickbacks come out. Because when they send $10 million somewhere, they get about $1 million kickback. And that's why they do it. I mean, these congressmen, these politicians, they're not philanthropists. John D. Rockefeller was supposed to be a great philanthropist. But all of the things that he set up as great charities were actually part of his business enterprises. And at his charities, he developed the business products which became his most profitable operations. Everything the Rockefeller Foundation has done has been strictly business. And the medications, the hospital taking over the medical profession in 1913, at the same time he got the Federal Reserve System going, was all intended to make him more money. Because that's what he was in business for, to make money. And he makes that money by taking advantage of you because you don't know what he's doing. Because these things are always presented as all of the charities and philanthropies have. I read all their charters years ago. They're all written by the same lawyer in New York, Elihu Root. And they all say the same thing, the welfare of mankind. And it turns out to be the welfare of John D. Rockefeller. Because they don't do anything except for themselves. They never help anybody. But they always cloak it under the pretense that they're doing this for brotherhood and for helping other people, that they lie awake at night worrying how they can help other people, and they're robbing them blind constantly. And that's part of the conspiracy, not only to steal from people, but to make you grateful for having been robbed. And it takes a real philanthropist to do this. You know, I said I was a protege of H.L. Hunt, and I wrote some books with him down in Dallas. And H.L. Hunt did not leave a foundation because he knew they were all fake. And he didn't want some communist giving his money away. I knew John MacArthur also, who had the Bankers Life Insurance. He was a billionaire, too. And John MacArthur was as good a patriot and American as you would ever want to meet in his life. And when he died, he left his money to a foundation. And that foundation today almost exclusively gives $350,000 awards to a lot of people every year. They call genius grants. And these geniuses, when you read what their projects are, I mean, you can't read it without laughing. And they also have a great bias because practically all the recipients of John D. MacArthur grants are lesbians because the lesbians run it. And after all, they are very partial to their own people. So if you're not a lesbian, don't apply to the MacArthur Foundation. You may be a genius, but you're not going to get the grant. And all of these foundations are totally taken over by people who hate the capitalists who accumulated the money to endow the foundations. They're always taken over by people who spend the rest of their lives fighting everything that these people stood for. John MacArthur must be turning over in his grave every day. Henry Ford, the Ford Foundation, became the most communist of all the foundations. And Henry Ford used to give my friend Elizabeth Dilling in Chicago $5,000 a week to fight communism. So after he died, his money has been spent to promote communism. And that's what it's been doing ever since. So I don't want to run over time here, but let's see if what I've got really important that I want to get across to you. Half an hour? All right, good. Oh, I can cover a lot in that. Pardon? Oh, well, I want to talk about the Reign of Terror. Now, what we're seeing take place in this country today, the sort of thing I went through at O'Hare Airport a couple days ago, terrorism. By the way, these two inspectors who were giving me such a rough time there, and I told him, look, I don't understand this. I'm not a terrorist. And this little Hispanic boy said, well, this is not about terrorism. And that was stunning to me. I mean, here I was being scanned and pulled out of line in the airport, and he said, it's not about terrorism. But it was about terrorizing me is what it was about. But he wouldn't say that. And this whole thing, by the way, see, we had the American Revolution without terrorism because these were real patriots fighting for their land, fighting for the land that they love. And the place where I live in Virginia, the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, and Thomas Jefferson's Monticello just across the mountain, I saw studies recently that it was these Scotch-Irish Presbyterian people who lived right there in the Shenandoah Valley who were the actual instigators of the revolution. They were the ones that wanted to fight. And they started the fight, and that became the American Revolution. Started right there where I live in Virginia. So that's probably why I'm out traveling in the country today, carrying on the revolution. That's what my people have been doing for 200 years. So we had an American Revolution without terrorism, but they had exactly the opposite in France, because the French Revolution was driven by hate and envy. The people wanted to kill the aristocrats, and the reason they wanted to kill them was they were inspired by the Rothschild bankers. The Rothschilds had become very wealthy, and they now had money to instigate revolutions on their own, so they instigated the French Revolution. And as the revolution progressed, they instituted a reign of terror, and they very quickly killed most of the aristocrats. Well, they ran out of aristocrats, but they still had the bloodthirst. So they started killing peasants. They put hundreds of peasants onto rafts and floated them into a lake and drowned them, sunk the raft and drowned them. They were bound so they couldn't swim, and they were killing them. They were killing peasants right and left. They did the same thing. Stalin did the same thing in Russia. He killed 10 million peasants, and this was in the Ukraine, which had been known for many decades as the breadbasket of Europe. Well, after Stalin murdered the peasants because they didn't fit in with his five-year plan. And the five-year plan, of course, was drawn up by people who had never been on a farm in their life. They were intellectuals who spent most of their life in libraries. So they drew up these ambitious five-year plans, and the peasants didn't fit into it, so they massacred them. Then they had no wheat because obviously these commissars in Moscow couldn't go out into the fields and plant wheat. They wouldn't know a wheat seed if they saw it. So Russia has been starving ever since, and we've had to support them ever since because they don't have enough to eat, and they're starving today. This is what happens when you have what they call state planning. State planning always is initiated by people who have no idea how to plan anything. They couldn't even plan their own dinner that night. And they plan the whole everything in the country, and everything starts to collapse, and it just keeps going downhill. So that's the situation. You have a modern economy, you have industry, and yet it's run by lunatics. You know, Ezra Pound, when he finally left the United States after being released, he was asked by a reporter in New York, he said, Dr. Pound, how does it feel to get out of the insane asylum? And Ezra Pound said, don't you know that all America is an insane asylum? That was his parting words when he went back to Italy. And when you see state planning, you have to think it is an insane asylum. And you get the feeling in Washington, I practically grew up on Capitol Hill, and one of the things I did there was to work for Joe McCarthy. And I am a member of the McCarthy Committee today in Wisconsin. And the John Birch Society, Robert Welch died, the guys who took it over or inherited it from Welch, they sold off all of the buildings up there, made a lot of money, and moved to Appleton, Wisconsin. They were going to take over the McCarthy Foundation. And the first thing that they did, when they got to Appleton, they said to the committee, you've got to get rid of Eustace Mullins. And they were nonplussed by this because I had been the spark plug of the thing for some years. And there were some older people in it, but they were in their 80s and 90s, and they died off. And so I was almost the last survivor. And these Birch people came in and said, you've got to get rid of Eustace Mullins. In fact, whenever I'm into something and people come in, the infiltrators, first thing they say is get rid of Eustace Mullins. And the only reason is because they can't control me. They have no control, no leverage whatsoever, because I'm going to speak the truth, and that's the only thing I'm going to speak. So, for obviously, this is the great stumbling block. Before they can go on with their ambitious plan, they have to get rid of me. And they always try. They work very hard. I think I mentioned, too, earlier, and I should have gone back to it, was that when I filed this $100 million suit in the federal court in Washington, D.C., down at 3rd and Pennsylvania Avenue, Judge Harold Green was placed in charge of it. Well, I didn't know it at this time, but I found out later that Green, a very secretive individual, was a German Jew named Grunhaus. His name was Hein Grunhaus. And he came to the United States in 1943. Well, Jews were not allowed to immigrate in 1943, so he must have been sent over here as a double agent. And so he promptly joined the United States Army, and he and Henry Kissinger and a bunch of other communists went back to Germany as the occupation army. They didn't participate in the fighting. They waited until people like Audie Murphy had won all the battles, and the war was over. Then in comes this influx of these people, a horde of refugees who became the occupation government of Germany. And Kissinger had the code name of Bohr as a official Soviet agent, which has been printed many times. He's never denied it. And one of his chief assistants was Grunhaus, who now called himself Green. I don't think he even changed his name legally. They don't bother. Don't have to. So Green came back and joined the Justice Department. He authored the Voting Rights Act of 1950, the Civil Rights Act, and became one of the most influential people in Washington. So they made him first a Superior Court judge, and then Lyndon Johnson put him on the federal court in Washington. So he was my judge, and he promptly dismissed my suit without a hearing. And so I took it to the appeals court of District of Columbia, and there was a judge named Lawrence Silberman, also Jewish, and he promptly upheld Grunhaus's dismissal of my suit. He had been appointed by Nixon. Silberman, he's still there. So Grunhaus had given one interview in his life, and in that interview, which I found, he admitted his name was Grunhaus, and he now called himself Harold Green. And this was the only time that he ever gave an interview throughout his whole career. He died 2 years ago. So here, Heinz Grunhaus, a German refugee, is dismissing my suit without a hearing because he didn't want me to have a hearing. I have been denied jury trial in every lawsuit I've ever filed in this country, every time. And the Constitution guarantees you a jury trial. And I stipulated in every court case I ever filed that I would have a jury trial. I've never had one to this day. Because the judges feel like they can do what they want to. And as Jerry Spence said, there is no justice in any American court for any American today. And it's true. Go to court and see how much justice you get. I had a... I had a friend named Tom Donahue, and I started him in a radio program. And he's a refugee today. He's on the lam. I haven't heard from him for some years. Because he went before Judge Barefoot Sanders in Texas, and Sanders would not even allow him. He would only give him 10 minutes to present his own defense. And it was a trumped-up charge. And so they sentenced him to 8 years, and then they allowed him to walk away because they didn't want to keep him anyway. So he's hiding out somewhere here in California, probably. I couldn't say where, but I haven't had feelings out here. And I've had a lot of people who had to go on the lam. Tupper Saucy was another friend of mine. He was on the lam for 5 years. Finally came back and did a year in Atlanta, and he's out now. But these people thought they would go to court and get justice. They didn't know there was no justice there. You can't get something they don't have. Yeah, you can't bring it in with you. So Tom Donahue, after I started him in this radio program, he became the biggest promoter of my books. And so I was on talk shows for 5 hours a day there in Florida, 3 hours with Chuck Harder. They ran Chuck out of business because he had me on. has no program today. I did 3 hours of Chuck Harder and 2 hours of Tom Donahue. And Tom Donahue used to introduce me on his program as Jed Hoover designated me the most dangerous man in America. And so, which he did for years. And so Rush Limbaugh was growing very rapidly at that time, and he had the program immediately following Tom Donahue. So he would listen to Tom introducing me as the most dangerous man in America. So Rush appropriated the title for himself. He began to advertise all of the United States, Rush Limbaugh, the most dangerous man in America. And of course, Rush was about as dangerous as a carrot, you know. No threat to anybody. But he used that for a couple of years, and he finally dropped it because it was so ridiculous that he couldn't carry it on any longer. But they put Tom Donahue out of business because he was on the program for hours a day saying, you've got to get Eustace Mullins' books, and talking about the Federal Reserve book and my other books. And they were selling like hotcake, and Chuck Harder was too. So they sent a reporter down from New York to take care of Chuck Harder. And the way he did it, he came to Chuck and he lied. He said, we want to do a big spread on you in the New York Times. And he wasn't even with the New York Times. He was a Nation correspondent. And but Chuck didn't know that, didn't check him out. And Chuck thought, boy, I'm going to have a big spread in the New York Times. This is going to be great. And so he invited the guy into his hotel there and wined and dined him and showed him all of his operation, let him go through his files. So the guy goes back and writes a series of articles. The main thrust was that Chuck Harder was a tool of Eustace Mullins and that I was using Chuck to promote my books and that Chuck was the sucker for doing this. So, of course, it was a total double cross because I had no influence over Chuck Harder at all. He only sold my books because he made money off of them and he was making good money. But... So I said to Chuck, I called him up, I said, look, I can refute everything that is in these articles about my being anti-Semitic and so forth. I said, as I've said on your program, I said, they call me anti-Semitic because I go along with the Orthodox Jewish position, which is that there can be no Jewish kingdom on earth until their Messiah comes. And they don't acknowledge Christ as Messiah. And so the Rothschilds, after they began to make a lot of money, they decided to start their own Jewish movement, and they called it the Reform Jew. They hired a guy named Rabbi Moses Hess in Germany, And they put millions of dollars behind him, and Reformed Jewishness became a very big thing in the Jewish community. But there was always a great battle between the Orthodox Jews, who believed who they were the only true believers, and the Reformed Jews, who only believed in money and power and having a Jewish kingdom, which would be at the crossroads of the world next to the oil fields. The whole idea behind putting Israel, the Jewish nation, in the Middle East was to eventually seize the oil fields. And that's what the new program is. They're starting the Crusades over again. The Crusades started in 1279, and there were 8 Crusades, and the Christians won the first Crusade very handily. They beat the Muslims, and they took over Jerusalem. Then they got homesick and went home, so the Muslims came back and took Jerusalem again. And then 5 more times, the Crusaders came back, and each time the Muslims beat them because they'd learned how to fight them. So we only won the first Crusade. So when you talk about a Crusade between 1,900,000 Christians and 1 billion Muslims, obviously the Christians outnumber them and should win. But the fact is that they don't know how to fight in the Middle East, and they never will learn. And Israelis only fight in the Middle East by terrorism. That's the only thing they know. And so that's how they've survived this long, with American armaments and terrorism. But when George W. announced this new crusade, it was to be that we were going to attack 34 Muslim nations and destroy them in order to end the threat of terrorism. It sounded like a pretty good program. And for the military-industrial complex, it was a great program. We're going to fight 34 nations for the next 100 years, the 100 Years' War. I think George W. thought of himself as going down in history as the hero of the next 100 Years' War. And that was the foreign policy of the United States, a policy which is so insane you wouldn't think a 4-year-old child would embrace it. And even today, it's the only foreign policy we have. We have no other foreign policy. And of course, our foreign policy should be how to get along with other nations. Instead, what we have is a foreign policy run by lunatics who want to make every nation in the world our enemy. And the rest of the world is not particularly interested in being the enemy of America. They still dream of America. All over the world, people dream of coming to the United States. Not because the streets are paved with gold. They know that's not true any longer. But the gold is in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. But it's a place of opportunity. And what other countries do not have is opportunity. And because they have no opportunity, they have no chance to improve their standing, to improve their income. There's no place there that they can do this. So all they can do is immigrate, and immigrate to only one place. Nobody wants to immigrate to China. Nobody wants to immigrate to Africa. They want to immigrate to the United States. This is the only country in the world that everybody else in the world dreams about. And that's understandable, but at the same time, you and I living here know that it's up to us to always fight for this country and to keep it a country that is envy of the world. And this is our great task, and this is what we can do, and we will do, because we understand it's our duty and our responsibility. We fought 2 world wars, which were totally staged, as I say, to knock out German industrial capacity. And they had the Bolshevik Revolution. The Bolshevik Revolution was perpetrated not only to rob the Tsar, but to put Russia back in the Dark Ages, to eliminate Russia with its natural resources as a competitor in the modern world. So what communism did was to put Russia back 100 years. In other words, the Russians are in 1880 and it's 1980. So they're 100 years out of this, they're out of the competition. Because any nation, when they get a modern economy and a good workforce, can actually become a great threat to every other country in the world. China is no threat to us because it's a communist country and they're controlled, and they're inundating us with their mass-produced products, but that's because of our government's policy. It's not China's policy. This comes out of Washington. Why did President Clinton cultivate the Japanese and accept millions of dollars in bribes for them? Because the program was to destabilize and destroy the United States. That's what's going on. And what is George W.'s policy? Practically the same thing. He's doing nothing to improve the economic prospects of this country. In fact, the only thing he's doing is to carry on the war against terrorism, which means you have loonies like these two guys in O'Hara that attacked me the other day. And all they're doing is creating dissension, and people hate to go on the airlines because they realize they got to go through these roadblocks to get on, and it's just not worth the trouble. So they're fighting this country. Your battle is coming right out of Washington. The battle against America is coming right out of Washington. It's not coming out of China. And if it's a battle against America, what is it? It's a conspiracy, and that's why you're here, to find out about the conspiracy. They could not do this without a conspiracy. If one person in Washington would stand up and say, I stand for America, see what the bumper stickers they put out, they say, you stand behind this country, stand behind the USA. They don't say, we stand in front of the USA, we stand behind. And because they're behind, we're behind. And that's where we are today. Language is very important. So all the slogans that came out of the 9/11 show the total poverty and hopelessness of these people because they're living in the past. They cannot face the future. And the future belongs to America. And we will have the future if we exercise our responsibilities. That's what the Founding Fathers did. That's why the revolution started right where I live in Virginia. And the people there have not changed. They're fighters. But because they're so misled, we have two senators from the state of Virginia who are absolute incompetent numbskulls. And in fact, I filed legal papers last week in which I pointed out that after the Civil War, the war between the states, the federal government continued martial law and military occupation of the southern states for 12 years till 1877. Not much is said about that in history books, but the fact is that the southern states were not allowed to recover economically because of the martial law. And finally, Rutherford B. Hayes, who had been a general in the Union Army during the Civil War, decided that there was enough of this. And he ran for president and said he would withdraw the occupation. And it was one of the most bitter fought presidential campaigns of all time because the terrorists in Washington were determined to maintain martial law in the southern states and oppress the southern people. And Hayes won very narrowly, and he withdrew the occupation. But as I pointed out in my legal papers last week, when the military occupation was withdrawn, they left in the southern states puppet political parties, Quisling, Nazi Quisling-type parties, and they have run the southern states ever since. And I pointed out that in the state of Virginia, this was filed with the court, in the state of Virginia, we have the Scalawags, who are now known as the Democrats, and the Carpetbaggers, who are now known as Republicans. And if you think I'm ever going to get a chance to argue that in court, you're being very optimistic. But it's in the court records. There has been no mention in the press of this lawsuit or about the Carpetbaggers and the Scalawags, which is what these people are. They're absolute scum, and the people in Virginia and the other states are working for these puppet Quisling political parties. So this is what we're fighting for, to finally end the Civil War. Over 150 years ago it was took place, and now we haven't recovered because they will not allow us to recover. They will not allow prosperity with the people because of the control of the media, the control of the schools, control of the government. They're keeping the people in slavery. And this is their only program. Slavery was forbidden by the 13th Amendment. But we have more slavery in this country today. We have people working 3 and 4 jobs simply to exist. If that is a slavery, and most places where they have slavery, they don't work 3 jobs. And if you have to work like that, then you're a slave. Absolutely no other description for it. So what I call for is the liberation of America, the restoration of freedom to the American people. That's my program. Now, if you don't like it, okay, but that's what I'm going on. And I believe that the American people themselves realize the necessity for this, the necessity for breaking off from this conspiracy of lies. They call it the conspiracy of dunces, which is not personally directed at W, but, if it fits, all right. But I feel like the prospects are good. I feel like that there's a new wave sweeping America. We're recovering from the recession, although they're doing everything they can to maintain it. The recovery has been very slow because we take, as Lenin said, you take 1 step forward and 2 steps backwards. And that's what the government is doing today, 1 step forward and 2 steps backwards. And that's keeping us down. But we'll grow out of it, and American ingenuity will lead us out of it, and that is my prospect for the future. Now, I think we have a few minutes left for some questions. If I guess people will come up and ask the questions, and I'll be glad to answer anything that... Okay. All right.
Hello? Okay. My question is, you mentioned something about working, I believe, for the Joe McCarthy Foundation?
The McCarthy Foundation, yes.
Is that Joe McCarthy?
Joe McCarthy, yes.
Okay. My question is, was he slandered? Was he framed? What's the real story about Joe McCarthy, and what was your work in the foundation?
Well, the gentleman asked about Joe McCarthy. Joe McCarthy today, whenever he's still mentioned in the press, he's the most hated man in America, reviled. They call him a monster who destroyed people's reputations, but they cannot mention a single name that he... Actually, many people founded their professional careers on being attacked by Joe McCarthy. They were promoted at the universities. They got good government jobs because it was almost a recommendation, if you were attacked by Joe McCarthy, that you must be a communist and therefore you were acceptable in our government. And I have maintained for years that Joe McCarthy turned back the tide of world communism. He did this because he attacked communism where its strength was, which was not in Moscow under Stalin. It was in the halls of Washington, in the halls of government. And because he attacked it at its source, that's why he's so hated today. Because that was the great beginning of the turnaround against communism. That's how the Berlin Wall fell, because of the work that Joe McCarthy did. He led this country out of danger from communism. He gets no credit for it. But that was what this man did.
Aware of what's happening today, some people are expatriating and repatriating. And can you tell me if you think that's legal, or what do you think about that? And also, I've been hearing that some people are thinking about sometime in the future the states themselves are going to be breaking off into their own state. I mean, to be in their own country, each state.
You mean people who represent themselves?
No, talking about the whole state being represented as a nation or a country itself. Like California would break off from the United States, and each state would be the same as. Same thing in Russia, what they're doing.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't quite follow what you're asking.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Yeah.
Having their own state?
Yeah.
independent state, absolutely. Yeah. Well, that's what this country was founded, as a compact of independent states. And they converted that into a federal dictatorship, illegally. The Constitution has never allowed this. This is what the Civil War was about, that they had the right to withdraw, and peacefully withdraw. And Lincoln violated that. Well, actually, the attack on Fort Sumter was orchestrated by the Scottish Rite in Charleston, Virginia, South Carolina, and that was the pretext for the old war. The Southerners never had any idea there would be a war. There was no reason for a war.
The point I'm trying to get across, do you see that coming for each state to break off by itself?
Yes.
And also about the expatriation and repatriation, have you heard of that? And what do you know of it?
Well, I don't quite follow that. I'm sorry.
It's called expatriation, repatriation, where you come in from being a U.S. citizen to an American citizen, being as that they falsified a contract and put you in there and made you a U.S. citizen.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I understand what you're saying now. There's a great deal of information going out about what it means to be a U.S. citizen and a United States citizen and so forth. That's quite involved, and I won't go into it right now, but it's a good move, and I like to see it taking place. Thank you.
Mr. Mullins, I believe to be a good conspiracist, we should question everything. I picked up a little book from Dan Pila Sr. called The Enigma of the John Birch Society. And that piqued my interest because a lot of good people I've worked with over the years are very active in groups such as that, common law groups, constitutional groups. And in this little booklet, it said that Robert Welch sold his candy company for several times the value of its worth to, it was bought by Rockefeller. Not sure which one, but in a sense then Rockefeller money founded the John Birch Society. Do you have any knowledge about that or comments about it? And if so, would that not make the John Birch Society very suspect in the Patriot movement?
Oh, I certainly do. In fact, I know personally that Nelson Rockefeller organized the John Birch Society because this is true. I know two people were at the meeting where he organized it and agreed to buy the Welch Candy Company, which didn't belong to Robert Welch. It belonged to his brother John. Robert Welch had a candy company, which had gone bankrupt during the Depression, and his brother John hired him for his candy company. And what Nelson Rockefeller agreed to do was that National Biscuit Company would buy the Welch Candy Company and make Welch independent so he could devote all of his time to the John Birch Society. That was a deal. It was a straight business deal. And his brother continued as a director of Nabisco. And today, if you look in Standard & Poor's, you'll see that John Welch Jr., Robert Welch's nephew, is still a director of Nabisco. So that was all arranged. And Revelo Oliver, one of the founders of the John Birch Society, who was a good friend of mine, told me that Nelson Rockefeller maintained a $250,000 rollover account at Chase Manhattan Bank so that Welch could meet his payroll. And whenever he drew on that, Rockefeller would replace the money. So Robert Welch was simply an employee of Nelson Rockefeller.
Thank you very much.
When referring to the people that hate this country and its people, you referred to Billy Crystal. Were you talking about the actor?
Well, the Billy Crystal I'm talking about is a would-be actor.
All right.
But the other Billy Crystal is an established actor, a comedian who has never done or said anything funny, but you can get away with that in Hollywood.
All right.
But other Billy Crystal was the son of a famous socialist in New York called Irving Crystal. Irving Crystal was a leading socialist writer all of his life in New York, and his son Billy then became the senior Bush's chief of staff when Bush was Reagan's vice president. But since W became president, he won't have anything to do with Billy Crystal because Billy Crystal became so notorious as the head of the Israeli Fifth Column in the United States that you can't have him in any government position whatsoever. But I call him Billy Crystal because to me he's a joke.
Who in the government right now is part of the Israeli Fifth Column and what offices?
Who?
Who in the government right now? What offices do they hold? Are part of the?
Oh, The acting Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz, is one of the leaders of the Israeli Fifth Column. In fact, he is running the Defense Department because Rumsfeld is doing the public relations and appearing on television every day to promote the thing. So it's actually Wolfowitz who's running the thing. So here you have an Israeli Fifth Columnist running the Defense Department.